Good morning. Please be seated. Case for argument this morning is 13-1564 FDA Hygiene Products versus First Quality Baby Products. Mr. Black, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chief Judge. May it please the Court. The Supreme Court stated in Petrella that it had never, quote, approved the application of laches to bar a claim for damages within the time period allowed by a federal statute of limitations. The Supreme Court referred to this Court's decision in Aukerman and noted that it had not had an opportunity to review that decision. We have that opportunity today, and because Aukerman is in clear conflict with Petrella, it should be overruled.
But isn't it possible that the reason they didn't have the opportunity is because there wasn't anything that needed correction?
I believe, Your Honor, that more likely, because this Court has settled patent law since 1982 in the United States, that there was no circuit split that developed. The circuit split in the Petrella case arose mostly in the last 10 years and led
that
to the Supreme Court.
That hasn't impeded the Supreme Court from deciding to take a lot of other appeals.
That is certainly the case, Your Honor. We take the cases as we have them, and the issue had not been raised directly. Aukerman and the Court's 1980s decisions on laches settled the point about whether laches was applicable. But in the intervening years, the Supreme Court has made it clear that it emphasizes that the division of law and equity was real, that the merger of law and equity did not allow the interposition of laches against legal claims for damages. And now
let me pick you up on that, because I wonder if this really is a legal claim for damages. In Petrella, lost profits was considered to be an equitable claim subject to the statute of limitations, and yet laches applied, correct?
That's correct.
Lost
profits, no. The issue in, I'm sorry, Ryan, let me correct that. What Petrella did is the first step, and I think it's the right one to take here, is to look at the specific remedy.
It said that lost profits was equitable. Even though it was subject to the statute of limitations, it still was subject to laches as well.
I believe what they are referring to is the profits that would be awardable from the infringer in an accounting.
Yes. But they said as to that claim, laches still applies, right?
As to an accounting, laches would apply because they said in the footnote, I think it was footnote 2, that while equitable, that accounting has both aspects of legal and equitable relief, it's a protean remedy and on balance is equitable.
Okay, but so why in the patent area isn't damages predominantly an equitable remedy as a result of the 1870 statute, which said specifically that damages would be recoverable in equity? Why doesn't that make damages an equitable claim in the context of patent law? It's also a legal claim, it's both, but most of the suits for damages were in equity in relation to an injunction, so why shouldn't we look at what the predominant character of it was and say as a result of the 1870 statute, damages in patent law, unlike copyright, is an equitable remedy?
I think the analysis is the right approach, but the conclusion is we respectfully disagree. There are three remedies in the Patent Act, and there are three remedies in the Copyright Act. Damages to the infringer, and accounting, which could involve assessing the infringer's profits, and injunctive relief. The accounting went away. It was abolished in patent law. But the analogy is exact. We have damages which were awardable for the infringer's damages, could be lost profits, but it's the infringer's damages, and that has always quintessentially been a legal remedy on the law side of the court.
Well, why is that? I mean, when the Congress in 1870 said specifically that damages are an equitable remedy maintainable in an equity court, doesn't that make it an equitable remedy?
Not at all. That is exactly the same thing that happened in the copyright law. Copyright law allowed for an accounting, and they then amended the law in about 1919 to allow for the ancillary relief award of damages as an ancillary remedy in an equitable case. So the parity is exact. The parallel is exact. The fact of the matter is that damages is a legal remedy. The fact that it may have been awarded in ancillary fashion in copyright or patent law doesn't make the remedy different and doesn't make the analysis any different.
Can
There's
I
no distinction.
Follow up on this point to make sure that I understand your answer? So under Section 504 of the Copyright Act, which the Supreme Court does reference in, I think it's footnote 1, not footnote 2, but it talks about damages and profits. And the actual quote from the statute is, the copyright owner's actual damages and any additional profits of the infringer. And in that footnote, it seems to me the Supreme Court indicates that the profits may be inequitable in this case, but it never suggests that the damages are. And is your position, as I understand it, that they have actually drawn this distinction between damages as a legal remedy and profits of the infringer, disgorgement in the old-fashioned patent cases?
Precisely.
And that would be equitable if it still existed, but it doesn't.
Precisely. The first step in the process is to look at the character of the specific remedy. A damage claim is historically been a remedy at law in copyright and patent law. There are situations where you can collect the profits of the infringer. That was done historically through an accounting. That was abolished in patent law but retained in copyright law. In the footnote, I take the correction, it was footnote 1, at the very beginning of Petrella, the Supreme Court said, first step, let's determine the specific remedy asked for by the plaintiff. Is it legal or equitable? And with respect to an accounting, they said there are elements of both in an accounting because money is awarded, but we find it's a protean remedy and that it should on balance be considered equitable.
So do I hear you saying that after the merger of law and equity, equitable courts are prohibited from providing equitable relief when the facts may cry out for equitable relief?
No, not at all, Your Honor. Equity is obviously still at play in patent cases. Injunctions can be awarded. That's the quintessential equitable relief. The only distinction between...
You're saying there's a limit on the equitable relief that can
equitably
be provided?
Under Petrella, equitable relief could be curtailed in light of laches in, quote, extraordinary circumstances.
Do you think it makes any difference that copyright infringement may be a crime and patent infringement is not?
I do not, Your Honor. Both...
Do you think it makes any difference that a copyright can last for 100 years, 125 years, and the patent is over when it's over?
The only difference there, Your Honor, is it cuts in our favor because from a policy perspective, the chance that you would lose evidence or that there would be difficulties and because of a delay is less. Congress said in a copyright case, in a copyright context where you could have 67 years of life, and where the author could be long dead before a suit arises, that the way to deal with that problem, the way to balance all the interests here, is to have a three-year look-back window. That balances the need to get cases to court, but also the infringer's desire not to have to file a lawsuit every time there's some minor infringement, and that was the balance that Congress struck.
You see, what I'm trying to understand why your position is that these must be treated identically. And we all know that there are giant differences between copyright and patent. The most obvious, of course, is that you have to copy to infringe a copyright, whereas you may not know that you're infringing a patent, and all of the other things that we've been discussing. And yet you're telling us, never mind any of that. This, they must be treated identically in this specific area.
I'm certainly not denying that there are differences between patent and copyright substantive law. But I cannot see in the Petrella case any room for distinction on the basis that they ruled with respect to copyright law from patent law.
If we were to disagree with you on that, and if we were to say that we regard the 1870 statute as creating damages as an equitable remedy, would you then lose?
I would not, because in 1919, I believe it was 1919, the exact same thing happened in copyright law. They had equitable cases at the copyright side, on copyright cases, on the equitable side of the court. And there was a debate about whether courts acting in equity had the right to award damages as ancillary relief or whether the plaintiff would have to go off for a separate action at law. And Congress settled the issue in exactly the same way as they settled it for patent law in 1870.
Not exactly the same way, because the 1909 copyright statute allowed the combination of legal and equitable remedies. There's no comparable provision in the patent law.
I think the point you're trying to make a distinction which doesn't exist between copyright and patent law, Your Honor, In equity, generally, an accounting could be provided in patent law and in copyright law, and in other areas as well. And the equity courts eventually developed the right to provide ancillary relief, where the main thing being sought by the plaintiff was an injunction or an accounting. They could also seek damages.
The Supreme Court cases dealing with the 1870 statute don't characterize it as ancillary relief. They talk about damages being an equitable remedy, right?
Damages is not an equitable remedy. It's a legal remedy which was available under the Patent Act on the equity side of the court. Equity jurisdiction was enlarged to include damages. But that was exactly what happened in the Copyright Act, and Petrella said damages are legal relief.
Well, one thing I think we can all agree on, that one of the distinctions between patent and copyright law is that the Patent Act has Section 282. So what, in your view, are the parameters? What does the absence of liability for infringement in 282 mean?
The absence of liability, Section 282 has, as you point out, it defines the defenses for in a claim for patent infringement. The absence of liability for infringement could mean that the infringer did not commit the acts which it is accused of.
Well, except that that is preceded by non-infringement, and so one would assume that that scenario is covered by the first and not by that phrase.
Correct? I think I tend to agree, Your Honor. We don't have a lot of legislative history on that, but I tend to agree. I think the absence of liability for infringement would also certainly include situations where the plaintiff has agreed to allow the defendant to permit acts which would otherwise constitute infringement, like a license, like equitable, like a license, an implied license, maybe even estoppel.
So how are we to know? I mean, obviously they didn't articulate, they didn't call out a license. So where do we draw the line? So you would be comfortable if we were to construe absence of liability to cover licenses. Well, why should we draw the line there? Latches existed beforehand. Why wouldn't Congress have intended to include latches in that bucket as well?
Latches was not done away with. It still applies to equity. It still applies to equity. It was a defense before 1952 to actions and injunctive relief and before accounting was abolished to an accounting. But it was not a defense that was recognized against a legal claim for damages brought at law. And we look at, if you look at Walker on patents from the time period, it says there are 28 defenses to patent infringement on the law side of the court, and there are two additional defenses that are only applicable to equity, equity jurisdiction, and latches.
Can I ask you, do you think latches continued to apply after 1952 because of 282 or independently of 282?
I think it continued to apply actually because of 283, which says that injunctions can be granted on such terms as the court deems just under equitable principles.
Is 280? I see. Because it is at least possible to wonder about the body of patent-specific case law on latches up to 1952, of which certainly by 1952 and a little bit before 1938, there appeared to be a pretty uniform recognition, much of it in dicta, but not all of it, that legal damages could be barred by latches.
I agree that there were some cases, but there was clearly no settled law on the topic, and the vast majority of the cases were on the equity side of the court.
Most of them were on the equity side of the court. After 1938, it became immaterial which side of the court. A few cases went the other way, some of them in dicta, including the one that seemed to have gotten all this started in the Fifth Circuit because there was equitable estoppel. Nevertheless, there was no declaration, no statement, no let alone a ruling by any court, was there before 1952, that made the legal damages equity distinction and said latches doesn't matter because for the legal damages because we have a statute of limitations? And I'm not yet talking about what to make of this body of law, but just as a descriptive matter, isn't that right?
On specifically patent case, there certainly was a body of law that
specifically
said...
Specifically patent case.
There's no case that specifically said that. And Part of the reason for that is we sit here today in 2015. We don't have a real feel for the division of law and equity anymore. But for those who were practicing law in the late 19th century and early 20th century, that was a reality. If you wanted to file a case, you had to decide whether you were going to file on the legal side of the court or on the equity side of the court.
Yeah, but they were filing the damage claims on the equity side of the court. That's what many of those cases involved. And as we said in Bosch, at that time, the reference to an accounting included a claim for damages as well as, before 1946, a claim to lost profits. So these cases, in saying the latches were available, were addressing damages, right?
They were addressing the ability of a plaintiff to proceed in equity. And the court said if you committed latches, you were barred from the equity courts. If you look at Lane and Bodley...
But on the equity courts, you could secure damages.
You could secure damages. And Lane and Bodley, which we were asked to comment on, is an interesting case because it said that latches could apply. It was a bill in equity. But we know that from the procedural history, if you look at the lower court case, what was actually requested was that the complainant's bill in equity be dismissed and the plaintiff remitted to his remedies on the law side of the court. That was the only Supreme Court precedent we have on the point. And it fools us a little bit today because we don't have the mental furniture to think about law and equity being different. But in the days when the statute was passed, we do.
How do you get around the discussion in Bosch where this court relied on the history of damages being recoverable in equity to say that effectively that a damages trial today is the same as an accounting?
Well, I think, as I understand it, Your Honor, an accounting, which was a particularly invasive, almost Dickensian remedy, the way they describe it, and into the infringer's profits, looking at the infringer's books, special masters, it was a very specialized procedure. It was often invoked because the damages could be quite, the collectible money could be quite high. But it was conducted by an equity court with a special master, not to a jury. Damage claims go to a jury. It's very clear that today's remedy under Section 284 is a legal remedy.
But we acknowledge that damage claims now go to the jury, and we still said in Bosch that didn't matter given the history and the development of the combination of damages and lost profits.
Your Honor, there are two schools of thought here. There's a majority opinion and a dissenting opinion in Petrella. All I can say is that the majority in Petrella recognized that an accounting was out there. There's a very long history in the Copyright Act, just as in the Patent Act, of allowing equity courts to award damages to apply complete relief to the cause of action. But it was no bar to the decision in Petrella, and we don't believe it would change the Supreme Court's decision.
Now, if we agree with your theory on latches, just to get to the substance, the merits of this case, you aren't disputing that you might nonetheless be subject to equitable estoppel, is that right?
No, Your Honor. Well, the district court granted summary judgment on estoppel as well. The panel reversed that decision and remanded it, and we obviously believe that was correct. But if your question is, are we saying that equitable estoppel is barred by Petrella, the answer is no. The court recognized estoppel as a defense, although a more limited one perhaps than has been in the way it's been used in this court.
You know, the entire thrust of the precedent, the Federal Circuit precedent in Aukerman, was to distinguish between latches and equitable estoppel and to determine what's right in the patent area without worrying about other aspects of property rights. And so there were distinctions drawn. And so, all right, so to be clear, you're not disputing the applicability of equitable estoppel?
As a legal matter, we accept that the principle applies to patent cases, obviously on the facts of our case.
Not as a legal matter, as an equitable matter.
I knew that would come at some point today. Fair enough, Your Honor. Equitable estoppel is a defense which was long recognized on both the equity and the law side of the court at common law, and it would still apply today in patent cases.
Is that because of 282?
I think, Your Honor, that it is because, the way I view it, it would be because of 282, but because of the second prong of 282, absence of liability for infringement, or perhaps 271, which says it's an infringement, whoever acts in a certain way without authority. There's a lot of discussion, and I want to expand on that just briefly. There's a lot of discussion in the case law about laches being a cousin of equitable estoppel. I think actually equitable estoppel is actually more like a brother or sister to implied license, and to license, which are
documents. Can I just ask for clarification? Maybe I've read too many cases in the past few days. Petrella also preserved equitable estoppel in the absence of anything like 282 in the Copyright Act, right?
They did, yes.
So it's, I guess, following up on Judge Toronto's question, is that, do you think it's because of 282, or you just think it exists out there in the ether in the absence of language, and 282 therefore means something else?
I think 282 was designed to maintain the traditional defenses that were available in 1952.
But that's actually exactly why I asked the question. I assume that was evident. If equitable estoppel comes in by way of 282, never mind whether it's Clause 1, Clause 2, or Clause 3 of the relevant provision, and it comes in because that was the pre-existing state of the law, why not the same for laches? Subject, of course, to the issue, do we look at the pre-existing state of laches as described in patent law cases, or more generally, because it appears that there was a dramatic disparity between those two things?
I don't agree that there was a dramatic disparity. At the time of the Patent Act in 1952, and before and after the merger of law and equity, the Supreme Court said you cannot apply laches to bar legal claims for damages.
And a lot of lower courts applied laches, a lot of lower courts, and I think uniformly, said that laches in patent cases could bar legal claims, though admittedly very few so held.
Very few held that. If it were really the law, and that patent law was the only area of law where the rule was not observed, you would expect to see lots and lots of cases barring the claim for legal damages, but they just don't exist. And when you look at the treatise of the time, Walker, it says 28 defenses on the legal side and two on the equity side.
Right, but that's not the only thing Walker says. Walker does have the 880B statement that's quite explicit, saying you can apply laches against legal claims, and then the 1951 supplement of Walker says more of the same, reciting three or four more.
I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll try one last comment, then I'll sit down. What Petrella has said is that we need to go back and look at the division of law and equity, that it's real, that the merger of law and equity did not allow the assertion of laches against damage claims where there's a limitations period. The court said, we've said over and over again, before and after the merger of law and equity, that that is the case. Now, why have they had to say that over and over again? The reason is because the merger of law and equity has created confusion in the courts. But today we have Petrella, and what they've said is that distinction has to be taken. And what it says is that we must apply the same rules to patent law as to other areas of the law, and we think that's the way the decision...
You cite Walker as a commentator on the particular issue, but there was a more recent commentator to the 1952 Act, and that's Federico, who said that he stated the proposition that the defenses listed in 282 included laches. What do you think he was basing that on?
I think all he was saying was that the equitable defense of laches and two others he mentioned are preserved. And it just begs the question, what is the equitable defense of laches and when does it apply? He simply was stating that there was no intent to remove the equitable defense of laches, but he didn't say, nor did anyone in Congress say, what would have been felt to be remarkable at the time, that patent law was to be unique and that laches could be applied to bar a patent claim for damages on the law side of the case.
Mr. Federico was as close to the process in 1952 as any.
I understand that, Your Honor. I understand that his views have been respected. My main point here is that I don't know what the Supreme Court would think that Mr. Federico's comment was sufficient basis to distinguish patent law. But I also think that we need to be fair about what his comment really is. All he said was that the equitable defense of laches is preserved. He didn't say that it was being extended to legal claims on the law side of the court, which would have been unique in U.S. law.
Maybe it wasn't an issue. It was so clear.
If we look at 1952, if we look at the 30s and 40s, we have the Supreme Court saying in 1935 that applying a laches bar to legal claims is something that's simply not done.
Except in the patent area, every case recognizes
only on the equity side of the court. Well, all due respect, Your Honor, only on the equity side of the court. And that's exactly what they did in Copyright.
Where damages claims were being asserted.
No, the complainant would be barred from the equity court. What would happen after that, in Lane and Bodley, the plaintiff would have gone to the law side of the court to claim damages. It's the same as in copyright law. There's no pertinent
distinction. Well, that's simply not true. There are many, many cases in which people have recovered damages on the equity side of the court, and the Supreme Court in numerous decisions recognized that.
I think you may have misunderstood what I said. I think what I've tried to convey, Your Honor, is that in Lane and Bodley, the complainant asked that the bill be dismissed and that the complainant remanded to his remedies on the law side of the court, indicating that at least at the time of Lane and Bodley, late 19th century, people thought that laches could bar the bill in equity, but wouldn't affect the plaintiff's right to legal damages.
Okay, you're into your rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. George.
May it please the court. I'd like to start with the holding of Petrella, which is really quite limited and not as broad as SCA and the amicus would have it. The real holding is that if you have a statute of limitations, then laches can't bar legal relief. That's it. You can still get equitable relief. The converse, laches can still be used to bar equitable relief. The converse of that is that if you don't have a statute of limitations, then laches can bar all relief. And that is, in fact, how it has been in the past.
So your position is this is not a statute of limitations.
Absolutely
not. And that's the distinguishing thing here. Can you think of any circumstance in which the result would be different given your traditional statute of limitations, which you can't bring a claim, versus the limitation on the amount, the tenure of the damages, which is what we have here?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. But what we have here...
What is the practical difference between the two in terms of how they operate?
Oh, I understand your question. It's the practical difference really is and this is discussed in the CTS case, which is a Supreme Court case that came 3 weeks after Petrella. Section 286 is much more of a statute of repose than it is a statute of limitations. And there's a whole list of practical differences between the two. Statute of limitations are procedural. They're subject to tolling. Statutes of repose are substantive and are not subject to tolling. 286.
But in terms of what Congress is doing, what's the real difference? Because really, isn't it about essentially a separation of powers issue? If Congress wants to set a period for relief, they're allowed to do so, and the court shouldn't interfere by interposing equitable doctrines. So I don't – tell me why it really matters whether we describe it as a statute of limitations or not for purposes of this laches question.
For two reasons. One, if we decide that 286, you know, looks, smells, tastes like a statute of limitations and therefore Petrella should apply, we're doing violence to 282. So we have Congress is telling us two things. One,
what violence to 282?
We're taking away the laches defense from 282.
Well, not necessarily. We may be taking it away to bar legal damages, but we could still preserve it to bar equitable relief.
Yes, but
which is what Congress is telling us to do in Petrella.
Well, what 282 though was enacted and that we have a legislative history was to preserve the defenses.
Okay, let me ask you about that, because I think this is, for me at least, is the most problematic portion. Hypothetically, let's say we have 282 and 286 enacted in 52, and we don't have any of the pre-52 case law or legislative history, although I really don't even see any legislative history. All we have is the plain language of 282 and 286. Given how Petrella tells us to look at statutes like that, would we still find latches in 282 without the pre-52 case law?
Absolutely, because Petrella is limited to statutes of limitations, and the CTA
Why don't you put that aside?
Yes, let me
put that. You're not getting a lot of traction on that argument. Assume that they're the same. The statute of limitations is in both Petrella and the patent law. So the question is, is Petrella different for patent law than for copyright law?
And so what I'm being asked to assume is, one, that 286 is a statute of limitations.
We reject your argument that there's a difference between the two statutes. Okay?
And two, that there was no pre-1952 case law. Okay, we still have latches, because post-1952 to today, the courts have used latches to bar legal relief, damages, and that practice has been ratified by Congress.
Where's the ratification post-52?
282 has been amended two or three times, and the Congress has never changed it. They're presumed to know how the courts are interpreting it. They're presumed to know that this court decided Aukerman in over 20 years ago, and it's been consistently applied that way.
Well, wouldn't that have then prohibited the Supreme Court from doing what they did in Petrella? How do you reconcile the argument you just made with the Supreme Court doing this in Petrella? Didn't Congress ratify in the copyright context?
There's no counterpart to Section 282 in the Copyright Act.
Yes, but we didn't predicate your answer to Judge Toronto or Judge Hughes on 282. You predicated your answer to them on the notion that somehow Congress was ratifying post-52 application of the law.
Post-52 application of Section 282. So Congress enacts 282 and 286. 282 says unenforceability is a defense. Judge Hughes asked me to assume that there are no case law before, and I did that.
And Aukerman was interpreting and applying 282. Right?
Well, Aukerman is based on 282, Your Honor, correct.
Yeah, but there was case law. So why don't you discuss the case law that existed
between
1897 and 1952.
I mean, pre-52, we had many cases that applied latches to bar legal remedies. We had the Brennan case, Seventh Circuit, 1950. Dismissed the entire complaint due to latches. We had Universal Coin and Lock in the Seventh Circuit, dismissal of a suit seeking damages on grounds of latches.
Can I ask
yes.
you this? It, my recollection of the cases is that what you just described is quite clear in the Seventh Circuit, which had a line of cases, perhaps mm-hmm. beginning with George Meyer and certainly extending to real legal claims. There's the Third Circuit case in Banker.
Correct.
And besides that, I'm not sure there's any case that actually dismissed a legal claim for damages. Is there anything else?
I have Frank Smith Hardware in the Second Circuit, and where they denied appellant all profits and damages based on latches. That's in the Second Circuit. I have the Hartford Empire case in the Fourth Circuit, granted.
On the facts, that one rejected the latches.
Yes, but it was available to.
I know. I'm not asking about statements that recognized its availability, of which there is a fairly long list of cases. I'm asking about actual holdings that rejected legal damages claims.
And in addition to the Seventh Circuit cases, the Third Circuit case, I have Schaefer in the Fifth Circuit, and Hartford in the Fourth Circuit. And the Johnson & Johnson brief on pages 6 and 7 lists all of the cases by circuit. So there may be more, but these are the examples that I have.
It seems to me that you're relying pretty heavily on some kind of ratification argument. But hasn't the Supreme Court made a ratification standard pretty exacting and required Congress to at least have some specific intent to have ratified case law and not just mere silence or tacit acceptance?
Well, I think the standard is that you have to have sort of a uniform body of law, which we certainly have had since Aukerman, and I believe we had in 1952. It's presumed that Congress is aware of it, and then I don't believe Congress has to... the fact that Congress went to the statute, made changes to that exact statute, and didn't perceive that anything was broken that needed to be fixed.
So your view is then that tacit acceptance is enough?
I think we have more than tacit acceptance here because we have the statute.
Is there any part of the legislative history that...
I'm sorry.
Is there any part of the legislative history that mentions any of this case law in any way, or decides to codify part of the case law, decides to not codify part? That seems to me the instances where the Supreme Court has approved ratification, not just mere silence.
Well, we have legislative history for the 1952 Act that there's two pieces that's beyond dispute. We have that the defenses to a suit for infringement are stated in general terms, and that Congress did not intend to materially change the substance of the established defenses. So we have that, and we have that these were established defenses pre-1952, and of course we have, as one of the other judges mentioned,
the problem for you in the legislative history is that the other legislative history, which is similar, but their reference to what they were codifying, they refer to the five defenses named in RS 4920 are omitted and replaced by broader paragraph. Well, 4920 doesn't have latches, does it?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. But the other legislative history, that their goal was not to change the substance of the established defenses. Latches was an established defense. There's no way around that.
Well, we can speak about ratification by Congress, but what about incorporation from the common law? In the 1952 Act was passed, and then also in 282 was passed. Isn't there the potential that Congress was incorporated from common law various equitable principles, including latches?
Yes, I think when they said that unenforceability, they were, I think if that's your question, Your Honor, yes, they were incorporated.
I guess I'm exploring the difference between ratification and incorporation from common law. Do you see such a difference?
Sure, I see that we have both here. When in 1952 Act, when the Congress says that the defense is unenforceability, that standing on its own brings in latches, estoppel, unenforceability due to bad acts in the patent office. It's all brought in.
I guess the question I have on that, just following up, is it seems to me that those two things may point in opposite directions. The common law of latches limited it to equitable relief, not legal relief. The body of case law, mostly pronouncements and a few holdings in the patent-specific area predating 52, went the other way. Which is it that the implied term latches through unenforceability or non-liability captured?
To me, the state of the law prior to 52, we have many, many cases where latches was used in the patent context to, in essence, throw the whole case out, the legal and the equitable. We have many cases. And we also have, you know, the Supreme Court statement in Petrella that if you have a statute of limitations, latches can't bar legal relief. The converse is, if you don't, it can, and it has in the patent world for many, many years. The other thing that's interesting is, if you go back in time, as Mr. Black did, you could, if you were sued in law for patent infringement, you could go into an equity court back in the 1800s and basically have the case enjoined based on the equitable defense of latches. So equity and latches was available to in essence, kill the legal case. And you'd have to go to a different court, because it was back then you had to go to equity, and you had to ask the equity court to enjoin the law court. But you could do it. And this court discussed this in the footnote in Aukerman, the Liberty case. And then you had a statute, eventually the statute was changed. A statute was promulgated, 274, which allowed you didn't have to go across the street to the other court anymore. You could make these equitable defenses in right in that legal case. So
can I ask you, why isn't the right way to decide this case, which would not be a happy way for you, so that's why I want to hear why it's not the right way, to say we have this somewhat uncertain status body of law pre-52, uncertain because there are a lot of consistent statements, not that many holdings. In the patent area, it appears to be out of keeping with the general, quite strong rule of latches. Petrella stands for the proposition that when Congress has spoken about timing of damages for a certain period before the suit, strong default rule, unless Congress speaks otherwise. So why isn't the best way to decide this to say that it's important to have a clear and strong default rule? It gives Congress, which after all is the controller of this issue, a clear understanding of what the rule will be unless it acts, and therefore defines the task for it to undertake if it wants to act. And what we have at best in 52 is something that is strongly suggestive but not clear enough, so that Congress, which might even be considering patent legislation at the moment, can have a clear target to address.
That, to me, that does violence to 282 and everything that's happened since 1952, even if you discount what happened before. And there was a Supreme Court case where the issue was the I4I case, the presumption of validity that 282 provides a clear and convincing evidence standard. And the Supreme Court looked at this court and said, yeah, they've been using that clear and convincing evidence standard for all these years.
Sure, but that's a patent-specific doctrine, right? I mean, the Supreme Court has also said when looking at our application of non-patent-specific doctrines, like the standard for injunction and like latches, that we should not have a special rule, hasn't it?
Right. It has, but Your Honor, I think the thought that...
Can I ask you this about the 1952 case law?
Sure.
I think there's clearly some dispute over it and what it says and how well established it is. I mean, there's clearly Supreme Court cases that say you don't apply latches to damages awards prior to 1952, but not in patent cases. Is there anything in the patent-specific jurisdiction that says, despite the Supreme Court's admonition not to apply latches to damages awards, patent law is different and we're going to, or do they just do it?
Well, Your Honor, patent law is different and trademark law is different as well.
Well, that's not really answering my question.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I'm not trying to set you up. No. I looked, I didn't find any case that specifically said it in that way.
I didn't find a case that said it in that way either, but the point I think I want to make is that the thought that only in patents latches has been used to bar all relief, and that's different from other areas of law, is not the case. In the trademark area of law, latches has been used to bar all relief.
Because there's no congressional statute of limitations.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, that makes a giant difference under Petrella.
Well, there's no statute. There's what Petrella, the situation in copyright law and the situation of Petrella is you have one statute. You have a statute of limitations. Trademark law, you have no statute of limitations, and you have a statute that's like Section 282. That says equitable defenses are preserved.
No congressional prescription as to timing of damages.
And more than that, in trademark law 1115b9 expressly says equitable principles including latches for trademarks. So you have no statute of limitations and an affirmative statute that indicates latches explicitly is available as a defense. I'm finding it difficult to find patent law analogous to trademark law given profound differences in the two statutes.
Your Honor, I don't see the differences as profound. One says equitable defenses, and then it says including. So it includes that and others. The patent statute says unenforceability. Unenforceability has to include things, and the things it has to include are
right, but there wasn't any clear understanding pre-52 that the term unenforceability in the context of patent law encompassed latches. Right?
Actually, there was, Your Honor.
Are we talking about the District of Massachusetts case?
No, I have many, many cases where the court found used the unenforceability term.
With respect to latches?
Yes.
To bar a legal claim?
Yes. The window glass case, Third Circuit, it would be inequitable to permit the claim to be enforced. Banker versus Ford, Third Circuit, rendering unenforceable is the language they use. Gillens versus Shell, Ninth Circuit, the claim cannot be enforced. Ford versus Huff, rendering unenforceable against the defendant. So latches was used to render an entire claim unenforceable, and some of the, and all legal claims, equitable claims,
Counsel,
those are a handful of cases.
Kelsey, you rely heavily on 282. I'm interested in seeing what happens to your case if copyright law had a 282 type counterpart in it. Would you still have a case?
I believe Petrella would have been decided differently if it had a 282, because the court would have been faced with two different congressional prescriptions, and they would have to have balanced those. And I think the balance is that latches would have been available.
Even under Petrella, it said in extraordinary circumstances, certain kinds of equitable relief can be barred. It said extraordinary circumstances. What would you say in patent cases is on the legal side in terms of qualifying relief and on the equitable side? Clearly injunctions are on the equitable side, but I'm trying to figure out in my mind, is there anything else? All the examples in Petrella, every one of them, is only injunctions and destruction of goods, which is available, or disgorgement, which is defendant's profit. Those two don't exist in patent law, correct? There's no destruction provision or disgorgement provision any longer in patent law. So what, to tell me, what, if anything, other than injunctions is on that equitable side?
Oh, reasonable royalty. And in fact, the
and damages in general, right?
Yes, Your
Honor. As a result of the 1870 statute.
Exactly.
Would a claim for a pure claim for reasonable royalty these days have to be tried to a jury?
Yeah, I believe it does, and I think what's interesting, but I don't think that's determinative here, and I'll tell you why, Your Honor. If you go to footnote one of Petrella, they talk about the profits and they say, gee, this is it's protean, there's legal aspects, there's equitable aspects to it. And the footnote goes on to say that for the purposes of this decision, the purposes of the latches, we're going to treat it as equitable. They're not saying you're not going to get a jury trial on it. That's for another purpose. But for the purposes of this, because it's protean in character, they're going to treat it as equitable. And then when you get to the end of the decision, they say that...
Well, what they say is they don't actually use the term latches as applying to profits. They say delay can be taken into account,
yes,
because it's an equitable remedy, and they cite Judge Learned Hand's district court decision from 1916, which says accounting is equitable, and so because it's equitable, we can do equity. But restitution has always had this unique character of sometimes being legal and sometimes being equitable. Damages, as far as I know, has not had that character of sometimes being one and sometimes being the other.
Actual damages, yet we have to distinguish actual damages from a reasonable royalty, for example. The footnote one in Petrella actually talks about restitutional remedies broadly. So we're talking about restitutional remedies broadly. When we get into what's interesting is in the...
A royalty is not restitutionary. It's valuing the thing of the plaintiff that was used without authority from the by the defendant.
Well, we have to talk about what royalty we're talking about. If
not the established royalty, I mean a reasonable royalty that you are simply trying to value it, not that the plaintiff was charging to 17 other customers.
A reasonable royalty was an equitable remedy historically. It was only available on the equity side, and in fact, pre-1952, we had two statutes.
But you agree now, since the Dairy Queen so on decisions in the Supreme Court in the 1950s, this would in fact be treated as a legal claim that had to go to a jury.
I don't know one way or the other on that, because the real question to me is how it was treated in Petrella. And in Petrella, it was treated for the purposes of looking at latches, looking at delay, looking at what remedy. There it's treated equitably.
Petrella never even suggested that a royalty was potentially equitable.
No. What they looked at, they looked at the relief available, and they said it was injunction or an accounting.
Disgorgement of...
They didn't say injunction or accounting. The footnote expressed says damages and profits. And then below, they say profits. Given the protein character of profits, we regard it as appropriate to treat this as equitable in this case. But 504, as they note very much in the first predicate part of that footnote, has two different kinds of damages that could be awarded. Damages, which are copyright owner's damages, or profits of the infringer. And the Supreme Court, it seems, draws a line between the infringer's profits being equitable in nature and the copyright owner's damages being legal in nature. Is that false?
No, I agree, Your Honor, and that actually proves my point on the reasonable royalty. You have actual damages on the one side, which is what the plaintiff actually suffered, and then on the other side you have the reasonable royalty, which is not what it's a construct. It's not what it's not the actual damages, and that's why there were two.
Why
isn't
it a construct for the actual damages as opposed to a disgorgement of the defendant's profit?
It's a replacement for it when you can't prove actual damages. So you in the patent
right,
context,
it's a replacement for your actual damages, plaintiff, when you can't prove them. But it isn't a proxy for defendant's profit.
It's not a profit. No, it's not. But it's equitable. I mean, what the Supreme Court was doing was putting things into equity. They're looking at the damages and saying there's actual damages and there's equitable damages. And then at the end, the equitable damages are profits. And at the end of that decision, they said, the delay can be taken into account when you're looking at profits or when you're looking at an injunction. So they separated the damages.
I don't see how reasonable royalty is either of those is the problem. You're trying to put the reasonable royalty into disgorgement category, and I don't see them as even vaguely...
I'm putting it into the equitable category because that's what I think the Supreme Court did. They separated legal actual damages, if you can prove you actually suffered, from equitable damages that you get when you can't prove your lost profits. So that's a distinction they're making, and what they're saying is that delay can always be taken into account on the equity side.
And whether the question becomes, to some extent, whether under the 1870 statute, allowing the recovery of profits and equity made the recovery, not profits, of damages and equity, made the damages claim equitable as a result of that statute, so it was subject to latches. And that's a significant issue.
And I believe it did make it subject to latches, and I believe we've got the fact that all of the, for over 100 years, we have circuit courts using latches to throw out all damages. It builds on that and shows where the law is today.
This has been really a very elegant philosophical scholarly discussion. Let me try out a theory of practicality, which at least to me shone very brightly in what the Supreme Court did. You have a 3-year statute of limitations. It's clearly a statute of limitations. It's absolutely 3 years, otherwise school's out. Wouldn't a reasonable court have said that in itself is so short that we're just not going to let all of you litigants fool around with whether you should have acted within 2 years and 11 months or the other issues that would come up in a debate of latches? That when the legislator set such an unusually short limitation statute, that was just intended, it was more than repose, it was limitations, and that ends it. Just go about your business, decide if they did or didn't copy, if they did or didn't have an obligation to the creator. And you just can't raise this argument when you have such a short statute. At least that's what I took from what they said.
Yeah, as a practical matter, Your Honor, you're right. The you've got a 100-year term, and you've got this 3-year period, the issue with copyright that you get such a short period. I mean, the issue about evidentiary prejudice is not really that significant in the copyright case. Supreme Court said all you really need from a practical standpoint is the work, the registration, and the infringing work, and all of those will always be available. And the other thing the Supreme Court said in Petrella was that in the copyright arena, as time goes on, it prejudices both sides equally. And as a practical matter, that's just not the case in patent law. In patent law, we have all our defenses of invalidity and indefiniteness under 112. They're all tied to a specific point in time when the effective filing date of the patent application.
But within that argument, the federal rules of civil procedure provide the trial court in law with an awful lot of leeway to correct those losses of information on the part of a party. The court can, for example, take certain facts as established. And that balances out an awful lot of what you're saying, doesn't it?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I mean, the instances where that happens is usually there's some wrongdoing on the part of one of the parties. I mean, the basic problem in a patent case is you're trying to recreate history from 10, 15 years ago, and if the history isn't there just because of the passage of time through no fault of either the plaintiff or defendant other than the delay, I'm not aware of any cases where you've gotten an adverse inference or an instruction under those circumstances.
But doesn't that argument goes a little too far, doesn't it? Because wouldn't that apply to any kind of lengthy civil litigation where there's a 6-year statute of limitation or more, and the parties may have been dealing against each other on a contract for 20 years, but the Supreme Court has made very clear that we can't apply latches in those contexts.
They made it clear in the context of the copyright law and the provisions of the copyright law. I mean, the difference, Your Honor...
You're not suggesting that latches is available in other civil cases outside the patent context, are you? I mean, didn't they say in Petrella, we have never used latches to bar a claim for damages?
Outside the statute of... when there's a statute of limitations. That's what they said.
Well, that's what I'm asking you, though. Right. The logic of what seems to me policy argument you're making would apply to any kind of civil litigation case.
No, it would not, Your Honor, because you don't have the presumption of validity and the clear and convincing evidence standard. You don't have, in the same 282 that gives us the unenforceability defense, in that same statute, we have the presumption of validity and from that, the clear and convincing evidence standard. So Congress, on the one hand, is giving more
power. Why does that... I don't understand why that matters, though, if you have a contract.
It makes it different from other cases because it's not a preponderance of the evidence standard. You're as a accused infringer,
so you think
latches
should determine latches should come into play when the evidentiary standards are harder in some cases than in other cases?
Well, I think that's what Congress did here. I mean, in the same 282, they gave us unenforceability. That they gave those defenses to the accused infringer, and they gave clear and convincing evidence standard, in essence, to the patent owner.
Can I just ask you one follow-up on this post-52 ratification point, or even, let's say, post-92 ratification point? Is there anything that Congress enacted that, in order to make sense of, depends on the availability of a latches bar to damages within the 6-year period? Something like what the Supreme Court said in Bilski about the business method provision. Something like what the Supreme Court said in the plant patent case, JEM Ag Supply. Is there anything like that, or is your ratification point simply Congress has attended to the patent statute, reenacted certain provisions repeatedly, never squawked at all about Aukerman?
It's more than that. They've made changes to 282, the specific statute in question. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Black, can I start with one question as a follow-up to Judge Toronto's question to your friend, which was contemplating that Congress is sitting now, redrafting patent laws. Is it your, how, if they were intended to include latches. Is the only way they could do that is to amend 282 to use that explicit word, or are there other words that they could use that are broader that would encompass latches and perhaps other things?
The words don't come to mind, but I'm sure that there are other ways to convey latches. If that had been intended, you would actually...
Like they could say all equitable defenses available in equity should likewise be available for legal claims.
Correct, Your Honor. The other thing that you might expect, which would actually make more sense, would be to amend Section 286 to say the time limit is 6 years unless a court finds under equitable principles that it should be shorter. That's not what Congress was trying to do in 1897. When they passed that statute, which was designed specifically to create uniformity because there was a mess, because judges were applying, because of the lack of a uniform standard, they were applying state law, which was a disaster. And this takes us back a little bit. There is no question that the merger of law and equity and the concepts that were applied in courts, which were common knowledge to people who practiced law at the time, are somewhat foreign to us today. There's no question that the case law is murky. There are cases in our favor that say latches should not apply in the patent context, like the Middleton case. There are other cases with lots of dicta. The vast majority of the cases are in accountings on the equity side of the court.
Where does reasonable royalty fall?
A reasonable royalty, under Section 284, the way the statute is structured, it says if the claimant prevails, the claimant shall be awarded damages, comma, not less than a reasonable royalty. I think it's very clear that that's a species of damages. It's a way of calculating the damages which have been suffered by the plaintiff.
On the copyright side, when royalties are awarded, are they considered damages under, 504 or whatever the provision is?
I believe they are, Your Honor. I believe they are. And similarly, if the profits of the claimant are awarded, that is damages to the claimant. If the profits of the infringer are awarded, that is equitable restitutionary remedy, as Your Honor pointed out. I think the real question comes down to the ratification point and really what the standard of proof here, given where we are with Petrella, and whether the Aukerman decision should stand. Given what the Supreme Court has said, that it has never approved the use of latches in the context where it has a statute of limitations, and given that the Patent Act has a statute of limitation, we submit that the...
Well, that's not quite true, because the statute of limitations applies to lost profits, and yet in Petrella, the Supreme Court was very clear that latches would apply to the lost profits claim, right?
I believe what they're referring to was the profits of the infringer, the
But the profits of the infringer were also subject to the statute of limitations, and yet latches was available with respect to that claim.
The way they analyzed the case... There are other ways to do it, but the way they, the path they took...
Is my statement correct or incorrect?
Your statement is correct because they said that profits of the infringer was an equitable remedy because it harkened back to restitution, which although it related to money damages, it was effectively a protean equitable remedy. And that remedy, therefore...
Even though it was subject to the statute of limitations?
The claim, what they said was that the statute of limitations applies to legal damages... reasonable royalty, but not to the equitable remedy.
It says that the lost profits claim is subject to the statute of limitations. No?
Yes, but we have to divide. The lost profits of the infringer are damages. The lost profits of the claimant are damages to the claimant. That is subject to
the statute of limitations and to latches, right?
I don't understand the case that way. I understand.
Well, it says specifically that should Petrella ultimately prevail on the merits, the district court in determining appropriate injunctive relief and assessing profits may take account of her delay in commencing suit.
Maybe I misunderstand it, but I understand that to mean the profits of the infringer.
Yes, but the point is the profits of the infringer are also limited by the statute of limitations, but also benefit from latches. Correct?
Profits of the infringer, yes, that is correct.
In light of CPS, is there a distinction between the Copyright Act and Section 286 that arises from the fact that under copyright law, the statute of limitations begins to run on the date of the accrual of the claim, whereas 286 is a look-back period?
I think one of the features of the statutes, which is however it's termed, both of them are what the Supreme Court has now called a look-back window. In fact, if you look at the Section 286, you actually would quite easily call that a look-back window because of the way it operates. It's interesting that they looked at the three-year statute of limitations in the Copyright Act, which is a more, in a more traditional form, claims shall be barred unless broadly.
Right, but isn't that, but CTS specifically states, describes the statute of limitations as something that begins to run on the date that a claim is accrued. And that's not what happens in CTS. Are we to ignore the language in CTS?
Well, our view is that that is a that the Section 286 is a statute of limitations. It was called that by the Congress in 1896 and 1952. But more importantly, the holding of Petrella is not limited to a statute of limitations. It says whenever Congress has provided a limitations period, a way to decide, a rule of decision to determine what is viable and what is not viable. When Congress has provided a rule of decision, the courts are no longer, they no longer need to act. They no longer need to apply laches. I think the fundamental point here is the ratification point. You have a murky record, cases going both ways. You have a concept which is foreign to common law.
We don't really have cases going both ways in the patent area, right?
I think the Middleton case supports us, Your Honor.
The Middleton case is the Eighth Circuit, if I remember correctly, and there's an earlier Eighth Circuit case that says that laches does apply to damages claims. And there's no repudiation of that earlier precedent in Middleton.
I read the case. I think it supports our position, and I think the area in patent law was murky, as it was in the merger of law and equity created a lot of confusion, and the Supreme Court repeatedly told courts, you know what, both before and after the law merger of law and equity, we've said laches does not apply to legal claims. We submit that it applies to patent cases as well, unless there was some clear congressional statement that patent law was different. And we simply don't have that in the Patent Act. We don't have that. And the support that the defenders of laches have proposed, a comment from Mr. Federico, a overbroad reading of Section 282, are not enough to distinguish patent law from copyright law and every other area of the law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both counsel for very helpful arguments. That concludes our proceedings for this morning. The case is submitted.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned.